Okay, so I think there are a couple of you, maybe more than that, have had some issues with trying to figure out how we're doing this posting of the writing transcripts and stuff. They may have any questions they want to ask about that that you might be able to clarify. And if you're confused about it, let me know, and try to straighten it out. So last time we talked at length about relativity. We'll be coming back to that a lot as we go. I think you played with the recitation last week, too. I got at least one email that had some deep questions about it that I'll try to answer, but I haven't had a chance to do that yet. So any questions you want to bring up about relativity? Were any of you bothered by relativity? I think most of you are. It's very strange, isn't it? And it's one of those, it's sort of the first thing that we run into where I think in some sense the power of science and the methodology of science comes into its own. And I don't think that's true historically. There are many instances where I think that's the case. But in terms of what we're running into, in this case, it really doesn't make intuitive sense. I mean, perhaps it did to Einstein if he really didn't worry too much about what Michelson and Morley said. But for most of the rest of us, it'd be really hard to swallow without Michelson and Morley experiment telling us this is the way it is. And it turns out that there are an enormous number of experiments that verify this strange stuff that we've been talking about, relativity and time dilation and things like that. So it ranks right up there with energy conservation from the point of view of physicists. And we talked a little bit about scientific truth. And in some sense, I think you can argue both cases, but in some sense it's very much true to me that there is no such thing as scientific truth in the sense that if you see that nature operates a different way experimentally, you pretty much have to reconfigure what it is that you're thinking, even if you thought it was true. However, that said, there are things that really rise up to the level that if they were overthrown, it would be such an enormous change in how we think that it's hard to imagine. Energy conservation and basically basic relativity are up to this thing. So it's pretty well established at this point. And any theory, if you write any fundamental theory in physics today, one of the things you have to do is figure out how to make it relativistically correct so that it can be valid as you go from one end of the string to another, which is not always easy. At any rate, what I wanted to do this time was to talk about other forces of nature and sort of ways in which we look at them. And one that you're familiar with and I think you talked also about in recitation is the force of gravitation. And this force is such that if I have a mass and I have some other mass, so big M and little m, there is a force between them that is attractive, which goes as a constant times the product of the two masses divided by the distance between them squared. And you might wonder how you figure this out or how you measure it. You can literally take two masses in the laboratory and set up a device. In particular, what they do is they tend to hang, or earlier days, they would take a mass and hang it on one edge of a thin rod and a mass on the other edge of a thin rod. And then they would have a very stiff wire that would hold that rod, such that if you twisted this a little bit, it would twist, it would just oscillate back and forth like this. And so what you basically have is this mass just oscillating back and forth. And then they would put another mass over here, so that this mass would come close to it, not hit it, but it would just sort of oscillate close to it. And it turns out that this device has sort of, it's a lot like the pendulum that works for a grandfather clock or something. It turns out that when you understand the mechanics of the pendulum, it has a very precise frequency, which is why we use it for clock. And if you know what that is, it's going to be pretty stable over time. And in the real world, it may eventually, the period of it or the degree of which it goes from side to side will slowly go down as it loses energy to air friction, things like that. But to a pretty good approximation, it's stable and you can understand it pretty well. So you can take this thing with these two masses going back and forth, and it's really just like a pendulum. It will just vibrate, and you can understand how often per second it does this, and it's very stable. And then if you put a mass right here, with this force of gravity, you have an additional force pulling on this thing, and it actually will dampen the oscillation. And you can look at how those oscillations dampen and actually infer from that the force that you feel. Okay? And then you can change where that mass is, and you can change the size of the mass, and you can effectively map out this dependence in the laboratory. Even though, as it turns out, gravity is, we're very conscious of it, but it turns out to be an extremely weak force. In fact, of all the fundamental forces of nature, gravity is the weakest by a factor of 10 to the 35 or something. I mean, it's an enormously weak force, and one of the things that he'll discuss in this week's recitation is sort of why, at least compared to electromagnetism, gravity, even though it's weaker, is what you're sort of used to dealing with all the time. So this force you've seen a little bit. The other thing about gravity is it's always attractive. And it's always sort of along the line that joins these two bodies. So these are basic characteristics of it. We talked about this equation F equals ma earlier that Newton had. And F equals ma, in a sense, is a definition of mass. Because it's basically saying, whatever this body is, if I exert a force of this magnitude and I can measure its acceleration, I can determine what its mass is. And that mass is known as inertial mass. This mass is gravitational mass. And it is basically the quantity that goes into this equation. And it turns out, although it isn't a priori obvious why it has to be that way, they turn out to be the same. And there's probably some really super fundamental reason that someday some great theorist will tell us why this has to be. I think there probably are some great theorists these days who sort of think they know, but some of these theories haven't actually been well established. At any rate, it turns out that for all intents and purposes, you can think of the mass here as the same as the mass that's used in F equal ma, but that connection isn't obvious. This number g, I think you saw and calculated things with last Wednesday, it determines the size of the force. So if I define units of mass to be in something like kilograms, and I have a distance here in meters, then if I measure this in usually the unit we use is newtons, then it sort of determines what the size of this constant is. And a way to think about it is it sets the scale of the force. If this is number is really big, then the force is really strong. If it's small, then the force is fairly small. So that's a way to think about it. So there's another force of nature which is called electromagnetism. And electromagnetism is a unification of two forces that you're familiar with in everyday life. One is what we call electrostatics, or electricity, and the other is called magnetism. And James Clerk Maxwell unified these two different forces mathematically in the 1870s. Electrostatics is what you get when you have your hat on a cold day and you take it off and you feel your hair doing this. You take the balloon and rub your head and stick it to the wall. That's electrostatics. Magnetism you're used to if you've ever played with little bar magnets or compasses. So in everyday life, in terms of what we experience, these two phenomena seem to be completely different. And in fact, for many years, people did experiments characterizing them individually. And more or less came up with mathematical rules that govern the operation of these two things. Sense separate beasts. And then in the 1870s, James Clerk Maxwell figured out that electricity and magnetism have a very intimate relationship. So we're going to talk a bit about what that relationship is. But you're going to play a little bit with magnetism this Wednesday in recitation, so I won't talk about that much. Well, we'll talk some about it Wednesday, actually. But today I wanted to talk more about electrostatics. And the thing about electrostatics, I don't know if you've ever done this, but if you take the balloon and you rub your head and you put it on the wall, it attracts the wall. I mean, it's attracted to the wall. If you take that same balloon and you have another balloon where you've done that, they're actually repelled. Okay? So for electricity, we have something that can both attract and repel. So it's a little bit odd that way. Strangely enough, when you play games with electricity and make measurements that are not so different from the kind I described over here, you can come up with a force law that's called Coulomb's law. And that force law looks very, very similar to the law of gravity. And it is the force between, say, charge 1 and charge 2. It doesn't matter what their masses are, but and you have a distance r between them. And again, this force is along the line that joins them. And again, you have some constant that sort of sets the scale of the force. If it intrigues you that we have some fundamental force of nature here that has this weird form, and we have another law of nature that has this weird form, and they're pretty much the same form. I mean, that's actually sort of a deep state. It's an interesting fact. Basically discovered as just a priority of what nature does. We basically discovered the law. But it almost certainly is something that falls out of the characteristic of how these things fundamentally operate in nature. One of the weird things about this, though, I didn't put it here. Typically, we put a minus sign right here, which basically signifies that this is an attractive force. So if I let this be represented by a direction that moves from one thing to the other, so you might think of an arrow that goes from this end to this end, and I ask, what is the force on this mass due to that mass? This force will be in that direction. It's going to go opposite that arrow because it's going to be attracted toward the other mass. And so when we are putting the directionality into these equations, we put a minus sign here. And that means this quantity is always negative, which just means it's attractive. And the mass is always positive. With electricity, we have this weird thing. It may have the same form, but now you can have the force be both attractive and repulsive. And we've never seen repulsive gravity, anti-gravity. It'd be totally cool if we did. But we haven't before. But we do know that electricity can be attractive or repulsive. So mathematically, the way we deal with that is we say that we can have two types of charge. You can have positive charge or negative charge. If you have positive charge and negative charge, then you have a net negative sign here, and they attract one another. If you have positive charge and positive charge, they repel one another. If you have negative charge and negative charge, they repel one another. It's all a positive sign here. So like signs repel, unlike signs attract, is sort of mathematically handled by however you algebraically create the sign there. But that's fundamentally different from gravitation. We only know of one sign for the charge of gravitation, which is mass. I would love it if we could discover that there is a negative mass, but we haven't found such a thing. So those are sort of the ways in which these differ a little bit. So one of the things that we're going to talk about as we go is what is the nature of force? So suppose that I have a mass sitting here, and I have some other little mass sitting here. What we say is that because we have a gravitational force, that this thing is attracted toward the other mass with some in some way that we can quantify. Suppose I put a box around that other mass.
How does it know it's supposed to be attracted to this? What is the essence of a force?
You can imagine for a moment this mass is just sitting in space by itself, and I very quickly take some other big mass and plop it down right here. How does this mass know that one's there? What's the mechanism? So I don't expect you to know. I don't know. What do you think?
Maybe because, in vacuum, there are no atoms, but then when that's there are atoms.
Yeah, of course this is also true in a vacuum. And there are atoms here and atoms here, so atoms do have mass. So So certainly there's a correlation between whatever matter is and mass, seems to be. And it is experimentally a question to ask, you know, does this work in a vacuum? It's not a but it does. So, what we saw for general relativity was that Albert Einstein used the equivalence principle. Remember, the equivalence principle being, if I'm standing in a closed box, I can't see outside, I can't tell the difference between whether I'm on a closed, in a closed box that is just at rest here on the surface of the Earth, or if I'm in a closed box in interstellar space that's accelerating at 1g upward relative to my feet and my head. Right? So the equivalence principle says you can't tell the difference. So if you then carry that to an extreme, one of the things he realized was, if I'm in the spaceship out in space and I take a light beam, as it travels over to the other side of the elevator or the box that I'm in, this box is accelerating upward during the time it travels out. Therefore, this beam will appear, from my point of view, to be bent down. Okay? So if I say, by the equivalence principle, I can't tell the difference between being in a gravitation, being in the source of gravity, like here on Earth, or being an accelerating reference frame, it means that gravity has to bend light. So he then says, okay, light travels the shortest distance between two spots. So that means that gravity bends space in such a way that the light travels a curved path. In other words, gravity basically bends space and time. And that is the conceptual model of the gravitational force that underlies general relativity. General relativity, the mathematics of it, is built on the distortion of the geometry of space-time as you change energy and for mass. Yeah.
So if, I'm sorry, I don't know. So if space exists in a vacuum, right?
Yeah.
What differentiates, what's different between space and ether? You know, the new idea of space and the old idea of ether.
Sure, a good way to answer that, actually.
Does gravitation travel on a wave?
Gravitation travels on a wave, and it travels as, I mean, the picture in general relativity is it travels as a vibration in space-time, if you want to think about it that way. So in that sense, from that point of view, you can sort of think of space-time as being gravitational ether. Electromagnetism, it turns out, doesn't distort space-time in that way. Although we'll come back to that when I develop a conceptual picture of how electromagnetism works, because in fact, it doesn't just take mass in general relativity to distort space-time, it's energy that does it, and in fact in the picture that we'll have of electromagnetism, we will have fluctuating energy densities, and so you might argue that that might cause distortions in space-time itself, but it would be enormously small, sort of a different scale. We're going to develop a different picture of light, and so the picture of light that we're going to develop will work well in a vacuum and doesn't require anything either. But I think your question is a good one. And in a sense, you can imagine space-time being an actual ether for gravity. Okay, so in general relativity, gravity, the force of gravity, is almost like a mechanical force in the sense that bodies will just follow paths in space-time, which effectively distort with energy and gravitation. Newton had a different way of looking at it. And sometimes it's called action at a distance. But we're going to invent a mental picture for a way to visualize the force of gravity. So let us imagine that this mass, whatever it is, creates a condition in space around it, which we'll call a gravitational field. And we'll say that the gravitational field has a magnitude that's equal to the same G that we've dealt with in the force law, times the size of the mass divided by the distance squared. And the gravitational field basically is, you can think of as an arrow, and the arrow has a length that's basically given by whatever this number is. So as you go further away, the arrow's length is shorter. And as you're closer, the arrow's length is bigger. And you envision a gravitational field as being a condition in space such that if I put another little mass there, we'll call it test mass, little m will feel a force which is equal to that gravitational field times the mass of that little m. So if I take little m, say this little m, and I put it right here, there will be a force which is equal to gm little m over r squared. Exactly what we were talking about earlier. And it will be in a direction pulled toward that mass. This is a purely artificial construct. What we're doing is we're saying, I don't know if it's artificial, but initially it's sort of a mathematical idea that I know that it's very real that if I put this mass here and this mass here, I feel this attractive force and I can measure. So now what I'm saying is I'd like to look at this situation and divorce the force a little bit from what's producing it. So what I'm saying is this mass, what it's doing in order to put a force over here on this other mass, is I can imagine this other mass isn't here, and I have this condition in space which this mass produces when it's here, instantaneously. And we'll call it a gravitational field. And if I have the gravitational field in space, you can think of it as little arrows that are all pointing toward this mass, that are bigger when you're closer to the mass, smaller when you're further away. Or if I put the little mass right here, it's attracted that way. If I put it right here, it's attracted that way. If I put it right here, it's attracted that way. Because you can sort of think of space now around its mass as being filled with these little arrows, which we call the gravitational field. And whenever I put a little mass there, the force it feels is sort of along that arrow. So this field concept really may sound sort of crazy, but it's not so crazy. Because you're pretty familiar with it. Watch the weather. Or pull up the weather map on your phone or whatever. And what do you see? You see maps. And these maps, maybe not today, but okay, Buffalo probably about right. But you see temperatures. So what do those temperatures mean? You can imagine that along the surface of the Earth, we have some map that tells us what the temperature is at every point in space along this map, an infinite number of them. And we select out a few representative ones, like the one in Syracuse and the one in Albany. And that gives you sort of a mental picture of how the temperature is varying with space. Okay? So if we said there are an infinite number of points here, you know, we have all these points, and we do a one-to-one mapping mathematically onto the thing, that mapping, that thing mathematically is what we call a field. Okay? So these would be representative points of this mathematical field. So it's not actually a new thing. This is what we would call a scalar field because it's just a measure of magnitude. Temperature has no direction or anything, right? It's just hot or cold. So it's just a, what we call a magnitude. So you can imagine if you're taking flying lessons, you may be more concerned about the wind speed and direction than you are about the temperature. So you could you can go to the FAA website actually and pull up maps of the U.S. that are very similar to the temperature field that we see over here on the left, but now it gives you little arrows which represent the wind speed and direction at the surface of the Earth. And if the wind speed is large, then the arrow is longer. The wind speed is small, the arrow is short, and the direction of the arrow gives you the direction of the wind. So you can do a mapping mathematically of these little arrows into something we would call a vector field. Vector meaning it not only has a magnitude, but it has a direction. So again, you can have sort of a field like that. So this idea of mapping every point in space around some sort of massive body, mapping every point in space and saying that there exists at each point something called a gravitational field, which has both a magnitude and a direction, is really just like the wind field here. All right? So that's sort of the idea. And it turns out to be really powerful, oddly enough, because in doing this, we sort of divorce the idea of the condition in space and the force itself from whatever it is it's creating. Because I actually could take many different masses or a different configuration of masses and manage to create the same condition in space at some point. So I don't actually have to know specifically all about a particular mass to know what its gravitational field is. I may want to know for a particular mass what the gravitational field is, but in many instances now, this whole concept of a field, you sort of divorce the idea of having to know all about this particular mass from the condition out in space that's causing this force. So mentally we're making a jump from I have this mass, I feel a force, into the possible existence of a gravitational field in space such that if there were a mass there, it would feel a particular force. Einstein's point of view, that would be the level of distortion in the space at that point. It's like a fabric, and you have a large gravitational field, there'd be a lot of curvature in the space right there. In Newton's world, you have this, if I have a mass that creates this field in space, that field in space might exist without the mass if there's something else out here that's doing it, and I don't necessarily have to know what it is. But basically, if there is this field, and I put a mass there, it will feel a force in a certain direction. Okay? So it's a different sort of picture. So when we get to quantum mechanics, we'll have a completely different picture of the force. These all work. Mentally, they're completely different. And even in some sense, mutually exclusive, and yet they all work and they're all, I mean, who's right? So we'll run into limitations for what we can understand in a sense. All right. So if we want to map out a gravitational field, let me I have a mass here and I say, what does the gravitational field look like? You can imagine taking a little mass, and let's say we put the little mass right here. We know that that will create a force on the little mass. The gravitational field there will create a force on the little mass that's about like so. If I put the little mass over here, about the same distance away, it'll create a force toward the bigger mass about the same strength because it's not so far away. If I have the little mass over here, it's going to create a force on the little mass, which is now much smaller because it's further away. It drops off as 1 over r squared. But notice it's toward big M. If I put little m really, really close here, now it's closer, so there'll be a big force. So you can go through this procedure and basically map out every point in space, and what you end up with is something that looks like this. So it'd be radially symmetric. At a given radius, they would all supposedly have the same size. And the length of the arrows, they're supposed to fall off as 1 over r squared. But you can sort of visually map out what the force in space should look like, or what the gravitational field should look like. So with electromagnetism, we have exactly the same idea. And now what we'll use is a little positive test charge. So now you can imagine if I have a positive charge sitting out in space, and I take a little positive test charge and I put it at different points in space, there would be a force on it that would be K times QQ over R squared, and that force would be represented by these little arrows. So they're longer when you're closer to it, and they point out radially, fitting in that force law. So you can sort of visualize this thing. And so what we say, again, is the way in which the charge interacts with the test charge when we put it down is that the initial charge creates an electric field in the space around it. And when I put the other charge there, because it's in an electric field, it feels the force for the first charge. So the field surrounding this charge would look something like this. If I have a negative charge, and I put a positive test charge in the space around it, now it's attracted toward the negative charge. So it would have an electric field that you could visualize sort of like this, because it's now pulling the other charge in. Okay, so again, that's sort of the classical view of what the force is. So we can make more complicated configurations. Imagine that I have two charges. Nothing else in space, just two charges. And I have this positive charge here and negative charge here. And I ask, what happens when I place a little positive test charge around this configuration? So maybe before we really look at the full visualization. Suppose I put the little test charge right here in the middle. This one's going to repel it. This one's going to attract it. So it's got force from each of them on it. So it's going to have a pretty good strong force that way. If I put it right here, the positive is going to repel it. The negative is going to attract it. And add these two together, a bit like the boat on the stream. If you know the stream's flowing this way, the boat goes that way. What direction does the boat go? It goes sort of the sum of those two. If you can imagine that these are
two strings pulling on it, the direction that it would actually go would be that way. And the same is true up here. If I go over here, positive repels it, negative attracts it, but positive is much closer, so you get repel. So it's going to look like that. If you go over here, negative attracts it, positive repels it, but negative is much closer, so it wins. So it's going to be like so. If I'm right here, the positive repels it, but it's sort of a small force because it's very far from the positive charge. The negative attracts it, like so, and you'll end up with something that looks like the sum of those two, about like that, something like that. So if you go through this game, mapping out all the points in space, you'll sort of end up with something that looks a bit like that.
Okay? And so you might visualize for this charge configuration that it has a condition in space, which we call this electric field, that geometrically looks a bit like that, which would have a different mapping from one that would have a single charge particle. And we're just sort of pulling this out of thin air. Okay? It's a way of visualizing this force. It turns out that mathematically, when you're doing calculations with electricity magnetism, that is also a very powerful technique. There are lots of calculational reasons why it's really good to be able to play in the space of electric fields. But it's more or less defined. It's the force you feel when you put a little test charge at that point in space. Okay? There's no obvious reality to it.
Okay, so if we have two positive charges, you can go through the same game and you'll find you'll end up with sort of a map that looks a lot like that. But we don't need to belabor that right now. So let's suppose that we have some material which is made up of positive and negative charge. So matter tends to be made of atoms. Atoms are made up of positive and negative charges. So I might have positive and negative charges in here. And let's suppose that I now put that in a region where there is an electric field. Now, remember what the electric field does. If I put a positive charge in an electric field, there is a force on that charge in the direction of the electric field. So if I have a negative charge in an electric field, there'll be a force on it, but it's going to be pushing it the other way, right? So what will happen if I put this thing in space with an electric field is you'll get a separation of the charge where the positives have this force that sort of pushes them to one side, and the negatives have a force which pushes them to the other side. This is something that we call a dipole, because you sort of separate the forces. But now you can imagine if I have multiple dipoles, so if I have material where I have these little bits, the same thing happens to all of them. And now, like charges attract unlike. So what you'll get is these two will sort of attract each other. And these things will sort of line up along the electric field. Okay?
So what I have This is something that's called a Wimhurst machine. It's really just a way to effectively rub a balloon on your hair and touch it to a wire so that you basically transfer electric charge to a wire. Quite literally, it's the same sort of thing. I have wire brushes rubbing the material, and they effectively pull some of the electric charge off the material, because what happens is different materials have different, what we call electroaffinities, that is a different affinity for the electrons, right? Different materials will latch onto electrons with a greater strength than other materials. So this is what causes static flame, or what happens when you rub the balloon on your hair, is that your hair and the balloon, one of the materials is more likely to grab onto the electrons. So let's imagine this hand is less likely to hold onto them. When I rub them, some of the electrons here will transfer to the other hand, and now I'll have a net negative charge here, a net positive charge here, and that's what gives you this attraction that you would feel when you do this. So we're going to do the same thing here, but it's going to effectively separate charge and put them on the wires, and the wires come and they then in these two dots. Okay? So this device is literally going to put some positive charge on one of these and some negative charge on the other. Okay? And then what I have is a set of sort of plastic beads. I have a set of plastic beads that are in a liquid, so that they should be more or less random. You actually can see them moving a little bit because there's a little bit of residual charge on, I'm going to call these electrodes now. Well, actually, because there's a little charge on there, you can actually see these things beginning to line up. Enhance that a lot. So you see how these things are lining up? This kind of thing is happening because I'm creating an electric field in this space. These, because that's basically the configuration I'm trying to do. Charge them up enough, I'm not going to charge them up that much. But suppose I now put these beads, like we just had, on top of this, and I charge up these two flat areas. What do you think the bead happened to the beads in the middle? So I put a bunch of positive charge here, and I put a bunch of negative charge here, and I have a particle in the middle. What would the electric field look like on that test particle? It's going to be pushed away from the positive and toward the negative, so it'll sort of do this.
If these plates are wide, in fact, what you'll find is the electric field. Whoa. The electric field will look a lot like this. You'll have some distortion over here. But
so here are our two plates. And now I've got these beads. So let's see what happens. You can see what's going on. So you can see in the center, pretty much it's straight up and down along this perpendicular to this plate. So this crazy idea of the field in space gives you a pretty decent picture of what's going on in terms of trying to look at it. So it works well conceptually. You can't see it, but whenever I take these two sides, those two balls, and touch them together, I'm literally shorting out one of these respect to the other, and I get a nice little spark. I can see it, but I think it's too far over here. So now mentally, you can sort of try to figure out what this is going to look like. It's going to be coming out from around the ball and sort of go flat toward the plate. So this idea of the field works pretty well in a lot of ways. Any questions?
Well, as the material go up and down, sometimes the energy goes in one direction from the positive to the negative.
That's a good question.
How is it going? I think things were going both directions. I think they will. Yeah, you see some going one way, some going the other way. That may have to do with whether they have a net positive or a net negative charge. If they happen to have a little bit of a net charge, then they'll go the one way or the other.
So I have there'll be a link on your website, but I have at some point I made a bunch of little Java visualizations made up that helped me teach very particular things in Physics 114 primarily. So we'll look at a few of those as we go. So what I have is, particle in space, okay? And if I give it a positive charge, then it's going to create in space an electric field that I'm modeling with these arrows to give you some picture. If this charge is moving in space, then the electric field is changing as you go. Okay, so that's sort of the mental picture you get. If I make it a negative charge instead, now the electric field is the other way because it's going to attract positive charges as I go around. So it'll look like that. The electric field in space is going to effectively be a product or a sum of the electric field caused by anything else in the universe that's close enough to it. So if I add some other particle, like that one, and I give it a charge, then you begin to get the picture that we have where the two may reduce their charges a little. So this is very similar to this picture, what we did over here with the demo. Or and so life can be very complicated, and it all sort of sums together. So that's the concept I want you to think about in terms of what the electric field is in space. So in recitation, you're going to play a little bit with magnetism. But what do we know about magnets is if we have a little bar magnet here and we have another little bar magnet here, they'll basically line up. Like the north pole of one will attract the south pole of the other. And we can talk about having a magnetic field in space where this bar magnet creates a magnetic field in space, which is the thing that puts the force on this other magnet that's out there. Okay. And so you're going to play a little bit with that on Wednesday. Okay, so any questions about fields? Yes?
Does fields like independently exist without a reference frame? I mean, if you move some charged particle or like a mass.
Right, so does the field exist independently of the mass or the charged particle?
No. It's actually like, people say that gravitational field is independent of the reference frame that it's in. Because we talk about, like, because like time dilation or something like that. So if we move the mass or the charge that caused the gravitational field or the electric field
fast enough,
does that change, is like gravitational, like time dilation, I mean, does it change?
Yeah, it does. So, I mean, in fact, that is the essence of Einstein's papers in 1975, whatever it was. And it's a very fundamental question, actually. So we've talked about how your concept of space and time change as you change reference frames. We now have talked about this field concept, and sure enough, if you look at the fields from different reference frames, you will perceive them to be different. I have some demos and some discussion that we'll do on Wednesday that will sort of get at the core of that for electromagnetism. Okay, so that's a fabulous question, so we'll be talking about that. The question that I first thought you asked, that you didn't ask, is also a good one, which would be, you know, do these fields exist independent of the mass or the charge, which is what we thought of as creating? And when we define them mathematically, basically the concept exists, right? if I have an electric field in space, all it says is that if I put a particle there, it will feel the electric force of a certain direction and magnitude. And I can sort of define that to exist regardless of whatever my creator. And the same is true for the mass. So then you might ask, is there any reality to this whole field concept? I mean, we're introducing it effectively as a mathematical mechanism to figure out what the action of this thing is out at some point in space. And once we have the concept of this field out here, we can sort of think of it independently. But is it real? So I want you to just sort of bear that in mind for now, because we're going to come back to it. But I can tell you that we can do, you know, you can take physics 142 or whatever, and we can do most of the semester's worth of calculations, and the calculations work really well using the field concept. But it isn't obvious that the field is real. Okay? And then there'll come a point where we'll look at it and it will, the reality or non-reality of the field will sort of dawn on us. So I'm going to hold that thought and come back to it. Okay. What I'd like to do right now is to make a fairly abrupt transition that will make sense later, but it won't right now. Because what I'd like to do now is to just drop electricity and magnetism for a moment. And I want to start talking about the concept of waves. And it turns out that when you look at electricity and magnetism, waves are the thing that sort of ties things together. But I need now spend some time conceptually with waves before we come back to the electricity and magnetism and look at how it all ties together. Okay?
Actually, mistimed my class a little bit, or I would have a few more demos up here because we have a lot of fabulous wave demos, so I'll try to make sure we have them set up on Wednesday. But for right now, I need you to just use your imagination, okay? So imagine I have a jump rope, somebody's holding it over there, and I do this, right? So you can imagine seeing this shape that sort of just seems from your point of view to move down the rope, right? And we call that a wave. Or you can imagine that we have a flat pond right here, and I have my hand, and I just do this, surface to water. So what will happen is when I hit the water, I'll have a little water wave that slowly works its way out as a sphere, or a circle away from where my hand is, right? And if I do this rhythmically, I'll literally have a series of waves sort of going through. Right? So I want you to sort of bear that in mind. And I'd like to basically analyze the wave itself so we can build up some language and look at the characteristics. So if we were to look at the water wave, we could somehow have a piece of glass as the wave goes by, and you're looking at the height of the water on the glass as the wave sort of goes past, then we might see something, let's call y sort of the height of the water level, and we'll call x the distance that the water is going, we might see something that looks a bit like this. So this whole blue shape is basically moving that way with some velocity. Okay? And we have a bunch of lingo that we use when we talk about waves.
So let me come back to the lingo in just a second. Waves can take all sorts of form. If I have this string, this rope, I can do that. And when I do that, then what happens is I create a single pulse on this thing that goes down the rope. All right? I could also smoothly do this. And when I do that, you would get something that looks like this on the rope, sort of like a sine or a cosine on the rope, traveling along. Okay? I could do any possible shape. I could create a pulse on this rope part, but electronically you can create waves that looks like this, or looks like a square, or whatever. So you can have all sorts of different shape waves. There's a whole area of mathematics, which is known as Fourier analysis, which says I can take any shape wave I want, and I can mathematically describe it as a sum of different waves which are harmonic. Okay, so this single pulse is an anharmonic wave. It's not harmonic. It does not repeat in time. And if I take this and I create a little sine curve or something, then that just goes and it repeats itself. So that's something we call a harmonic wave. I can create it with bigger or smaller jerks of my hand, and I can make it go slow, or I can make it go very fast. And it turns out that regardless of the shape of the wave, I can describe it mathematically as a sum of harmonic waves. Mathematically, with different with different heights and different frequencies, we call it different time. Okay, that turns out to be extremely powerful because it means I don't really have to worry about the infinite number of possibilities for anharmonic waves. All I have to do is understand harmonic waves that look like cosine waves. So it turns out to be extremely powerful. It's also the basis behind synthesizers, if you will, music. I mean, we're going to talk a lot about music because music waves are also very much a piece of this. I can create an instrument that can play sounds effectively by giving me harmonic vibrations in something. And I can do it with different frequencies so that we hear it as different pitches. Okay? And I can do it with different intensities or different degrees of shaping it back and forth. And I can combine those, and I can create any sound you want. Okay, so it's not just a mathematical theorem. It works in reality. So it's an interesting sort of thing. And we'll come back. I mean, we'll be talking about that as we go. But it's called Fourier analysis and superposition. These are sort of catchwords that we'll use. So the message in all of that is you can imagine having waves of an infinite sort, but we really only need to worry about characterizing something that looks like that. Okay? And so that's what we worry about. And if we have a wave like this, let's imagine that I have a source of this wave on a string. Let's say it's on a string or it's a water wave or whatever. And that source is sort of infinitely far away and it's been going forever. So this basically can imagine this curve going on forever that way and forever that way for simplicity, okay? And this whole shape is just moving along, okay? We call the height above that center line the amplitude. We'll talk more about it as we go, but sound, for example, is a wave in here, and we'll characterize it. What you perceive as intensity is the square of this amplitude. It's actually also a measure of how much energy is being carried by this wave. So you can think of amplitude as sort of being a measure of intensity.
And the amplitude will be the same on the upside as it is on the downside. So the distance between the top of the wave peaks and the troughs would be twice the amplitude. This wave has a spatial periodicity. You can imagine the shape is sort of moving in space right now with some velocity that way. All of the peaks are moving at the same velocity. If I freeze time for a moment and we look at this spatial periodicity, it will repeat. Say I start here, I come back to the same place. I start here, I come back to the same place. So the shape repeats itself. It repeats itself with a spatial periodicity, which we call the wavelength. And it has a symbol lambda. So the funny thing about waves is the wave shape moves along the stream or the water. But if I put a piece of tape on the stream, as this wave shape goes past, that piece of tape goes up and down. It doesn't go that way. And the same is true for water. If you put a cork on the surface of a pond, or if you're in a wave pool and a wave hits you, I'm not talking about a big surfing wave. Let's do, you know, sort of small waves. So you're just sort of doing this as the waves go past in the wave pool. You don't really go into the shore as the wave goes by. What happens is you get lifted up and you go back down. So as the cork is on the pond, as the wave goes through, the cork just sort of does this and stays on the surface of the thing. But the wave itself, that pattern moves. So this is a big characteristic of waves. So it turns out that a wave is not a movement of the mass or the particles along the wave. It's periodic movement straight up and down. So you would have a particle here. Let's imagine what's happening if you're a particle right here. You have a cork right here on the water wave, and the water wave is moving this way. And what will happen is, as the wave moves this way, the cork is going to drop back down. So by the time this piece gets here, the cork is moved down. When this piece gets here, the cork is right here. When this piece gets here, the cork is at the bottom. When this piece gets here, the cork is back up to the top. So what you find is that the motion of a particle in the wave itself does this. It just goes up and down. This particle will execute one full down and up motion in the time it takes this wave to go from here to there. So when the wave moves one wavelength, that particle has moved up and back up to where it is. So we say that that particle has executed its full motion in one period of the wave. And every wavelength that goes by, that particle does it again. Okay, smoothly. So we define frequency as 1 over this period. So a way to think about it is
if the wavelength is really long for how fast the wave is moving, then this particle executes this motion slowly. The cork on top of the water moves slowly. And we say that it has a low frequency. If the wave is shorter wavelength, then this particle has to move fast. We call it higher frequency. Okay? Frequency is really what we use to characterize waves of different sorts. If it is a vibrating string and it's creating waves that are such that we can hear them, if you imagine a spot on the string, if it's moving slowly, you would perceive that as a low pitch. If it's vibrating really fast, you'll perceive that as a high pitch in the sound waves that are reaching your ear. So the thing that you observe about waves, say sound waves, really is this frequency. That's sort of the thing you often want to get at.
So we use this different symbols for this. Generally for sound, we might use F. For light, where we're going is light is a wave, and so we'll talk a lot about that. But if we do light, often the symbol we use is nu. Conceptually, it means the same thing. At any rate, this may seem a little bit boring at first, but waves lead to music and sound, which is very cool. Turns out that waves are also what drives quantum mechanics. So in a sense, I could just call this whole course a wave course, because it's really what it's all about. So I think you'll find this will be a whole lot of fun, and I hope I'll have some good demos next time. Anyway, I'm out of time. Okay.